This is Audible.
This is the Harper Audio edition of Fair Tax, The Truth, Answering the Critics. The book was written by Neil Bortz and Congressman John Linder with the help of Rob Woodall. And this voice you hear reading the book to you is that of Neil Bortz. It's copyright 2008 by Neil Bortz and John Linder. Production copyright 2008 by Harper Collins Publishers. Now, the first segment of the book, we entitled Preface, The Birth of a Movement. Now, you know how these conversations get started. You and a few friends start talking about how to make the world a better place. You have those conversations all the time, don't you? Most likely something, good or bad, has happened recently to precipitate it. Maybe one of you's had a stroke of good fortune, a new job, a successful new business venture, a wedding, a new birth in the family. Maybe one of you has witnessed a tragedy, found a new gratefulness for what you have. Maybe you've just received a big hug from your spouse and kids, and you just have that all is right with the world feeling that you want to share with other people. However it starts, this kind of conversation, how can you spread the feeling? How can we make things better for others, as good as the way they've been going for us? In the case of the fair tax now, the conversation lasted 12 years so far, and it's still going. We've all talked about taxes at one time or another, and most of us have wished or we've wondered about how to improve the mess that is our federal income tax system. Many of us have even wondered about other kinds of taxes, including consumption taxes and sales taxes. It was a group of three men in Texas in 1995 whose thoughts first led them to the idea of the fair tax, and their conversation started that same way. What's wrong here? How can we help fix it? What made this an unusual conversation is that it was a conversation among men of means. I mean, big-time means. Each one of these men, a fabulously successful businessman and a philanthropist in his own right. These three men had recently participated in a successful campaign to bring about change in Texas, their home, an effort that saved Texans $1.5 billion in insurance premiums in the first 3 years alone. The conversation on this day in Texas was how their Texas experience could help them tackle a national problem. Now let's think beyond Texas, they said. What are the pressing problems that are hurting our nation as a whole? Too many regulations? Too little participation in what we call the democratic process? Wait. What about this terrible tax code of ours? Each of these men has spent countless hours pondering business decisions based not on what was good or bad for their employees, customers, and shareholders, but rather on what would have been the tax implications. Now, instead, they began to imagine a system in which decisions, business decisions, could be based on what's best for the individual or the business, rather than on what would fly under our convoluted tax code. Each one of these men knew that the tax code was crippling our economy. Now they started talking about what they could do about it. There was just one difference between our own idle conversations and this conversation. These men would act on their ideas. They resolved to start with a completely blank slate and see where the effort led them. As they started researching the project, examining volumes of tax literature, they found an endless trail of ideas for tweaking the current code to achieve specific economic or social goals. If you want to encourage ethanol production, do this. If you want to help marriages stay together, do that. If you want to help keep manufacturing jobs in this country, try the other thing. All of these prescriptions, many of which ran counter to one another, were predicated on changing the current federal income tax code. As the fair tax founders looked further, however, they found another collection of articles out there, a smaller but more intriguing body of thought by scholars and theorists who believed that the United States would be best served by broad reform and bigger ideas. It was in those articles that they first came upon the idea of optimum reform. So as they sifted through the information, a group of 15 brilliant scholars and theorists rose to the top of the stack. The businessmen contacted each one of these highly respected thinkers, asking every one of them if they would be willing to participate in a new optimum reform effort. All 15 said, "Yep, you got it, we'll do it." And after a series of meetings, 8 of these people were chosen to participate. With their business backgrounds, the 3 men spearheading the fledgling effort knew the value of giving the customer what he wants and needs. So once they assembled their economic team, these 8 men, their next step was to find out what the customer, and that would be you, the American taxpayer, what you wanted. Okay, now let's digress for a moment. The fact is, we have a very strange relationship with success in this country. Everybody wants to be successful, but there's a vocal minority out there that insists on denigrating those people who actually achieve great things. Now, some people call this wealth envy. Our experience with successful people is very different. Our experience is that those who have their economic house in order are the most willing to help others find that same success. That was the motivation for the founders of the Fair Tax as they began telling their friends about their quest to develop a better tax code. It wasn't long before offers of help and funding began to come in. Now, of course, the founders and their friends were receiving nothing for their efforts, no salary, no expense reimbursements, no perks, no profits. On the contrary, they all made contributions to the effort. They all had their financial houses in order. They had lawyers, they had accountants to sort out their tax bills and to keep them as low as possible within the law. In fact, one of these men was both a lawyer and a CPA who had made a living for years, helping others access the benefits available to them in the tax code. Abolishing the very tax code he utilized for the benefit of his clients, as the Fair Tax would ultimately do, offered him no special personal benefit. These men gave of themselves and their resources simply because it was the right thing to do. Now, please remember that later, when we come to the subject of charitable giving, the beneficiaries of these men's efforts are the working men and women of America and their children and their grandchildren. Okay, there's the end of our digression. Let's get back to this customer, that's you, and what he wants. A man named Philip Carroll, the CEO of Shell Oil, offered to help. He put the group in touch with Shell's in-house opinion researchers and Shell's outside consultants, and so the effort began. Of course, it sounds a tad optimistic in retrospect, but the group decided that a $4.5 million budget and an 18-month window would allow them the time to do the research that they needed to do and to take the solution to Congress and to help get it passed into law. Now, remember, these guys are trying to change our tax code. They thought they could do it on $4.5 million in 18 months and then get it enacted? Well, they tried. But, of course, these Washington outsiders never dreamed of the buzzsaw that they were going to run into when they brought the idea of comprehensive tax reform and simplification inside the Beltway. Now, you know, maybe in retrospect, it's better that they didn't. If they'd known the effort would take closer to 18 years than 18 months, they might have thought twice about the whole idea. But they started anyway. First, they did a little national polling to find out how Americans viewed the tax system, what they wanted to change. Then they asked their economist, the 8 that they hired, remember them, to start designing an optimum tax system around the wishes of the taxpayers. They set up focus groups in 4 major cities, delving into the wants and needs of Americans in great detail. The results of each focus group were sent back to the economist as they refined the tax proposal. Now, do you notice anything missing here? What you notice here that's missing is politics. We have groups, focus groups, that are interviewing the American people. We have a research firm that's doing research on the wants and needs of the American people. We have economists working on this problem. You don't have politicians. They were looking for solutions, not more problems. Nope. No politicians in the mix here. These were private sector economists and tax experts and private citizens. This new tax plan was developed not by politicians, but by the people of this country. It was in the very first focus group that it became apparent that the income tax was only part of the problem. This particular focus group was held in Chicago, and one of the attendees was a gentleman who worked days at a local manufacturing plant. He talked about the impact of the payroll tax, not the income tax, the payroll tax on his life and his wages. At the end of the year, he said, he got most of his income tax money back. The payroll tax, on the other hand, was by far the largest tax he paid. It was the payroll tax that confounded his ability to save for his future and his family's future. And other people in that focus group, they agreed. And this led to one of the major elements of the fair tax. You can't just fix the income tax. The payroll tax needs fixing too. That's why the flat tax isn't that great an idea, folks. We can't just fix the income tax, okay? For the sake of Americans working for wages, which is almost every low and middle income American, the payroll tax would have to be included in this tax reform proposal. As the focus groups and economic research continued, it became obvious that the current income tax could never provide a workable foundation for an optimal solution. Citizens and experts alike perceived that a new direction was needed to accomplish all the goals that were being developed. The one idea that addressed all of their concerns was a consumption tax. Now, let me intercede here, and this is not in the book, but I want to tell you about the three men that started this effort at tax reform. They had decided that whatever their economist and focus groups came up with, they were going to get behind it, and they were going to push it to try to make it happen. But all along, they thought that their team, the economist, the people, the focus groups, all along, they thought their team was going to come up with an idea for a flat tax. When the package was opened, so to speak, and it turned out to be a consumption tax, well, they were as surprised as anybody else. But they said, okay, this is what we've developed. Let's move forward. In another one of these focus groups, as the tax reform plan began to take shape, one participant commented that she appreciated the direction in which the tax plan was going, that it was a fair tax, and it should have a name to reflect that. Well, right there, in that group, the name Fair Tax was born. By 1997, the Fair Tax had taken shape. By this time, the trio of Fair Tax founders had become a larger group of citizens. Picking up a cue from the focus group, it took the name of Americans for Fair Taxation, or AFFT. Originally, the group called itself the AFT until they got a nasty little cease and desist letter from the American Federation of Teachers. You see, apparently only one AFT permitted in this country, so they just added the second F, and it's the Americans for Fair Taxation, and we have another silly little American lawsuit avoided. Once the initial public opinion and economic research had been completed, it was time to see how the Americans would react to this idea. After surveying public opinion on tax issues in 15 media markets across the country, the AFFT ran a short advertising campaign introducing the fair tax concept and what it hoped to bring to America. Then, after the ads had made their impact, it took another poll, and the results surprised even the most seasoned advertising executives. People loved the fair tax, and they were gravitating toward it in unheard-of numbers. To make the fair tax a reality, though, the AFFT needed more. To take the issue to Washington, D.C., it would need people who were willing to put their name behind the plan. So, another round of advertising and polling. The AFFT learned that people were willing to act on their enthusiasm for the fair tax. Yet another round of ads and polls confirmed that they'd be willing to spread the word by sharing their passion with their friends and neighbors. With such a showing of enthusiasm buoying their efforts, the AFFT developed literature, marketing plan, volunteer response center, and more. They gathered more than 1 million signatures on fair tax petitions. They launched the website, fairtax.org, and began the nationwide movement that continues today. During the years when the fair tax was being developed, Texas Congressman Bill Archer was chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee. They handle all the tax legislation in the U.S. House of Representatives. Chairman Archer knew of the efforts of the AFFT, and he gave it the name of several House members who might be helpful. One of those men was Congressman John Linder from Georgia. Another was Colin Peterson from Minnesota, a Democrat. Linder met with the group in May of 1999. By July of that year, he and Colin Peterson had introduced the Fair Tax Act of 1999. Now, this is important to note here, folks. The original Fair Tax Act was introduced by a Democrat and a Republican. This is not a Republican bill. By the end of that year, three more Democrats and three more Republicans had signed on as co-sponsors. The bipartisan fair tax reform effort was underway. Now, since that time, the effort, needless to say, has grown a bit in Congress. From those eight sponsors in 1999 and the 106th Congress, the number of fair tax sponsors has grown to 69 in the House and 5 in the Senate. And by the time you listen to this, those numbers should have grown substantially. The fair tax is a national grassroots phenomenon, and now you are a part of it. The next chapter here, we cleverly titled The Introduction. This book is a sequel to the Fair Tax book, which was published in 2005. No, that doesn't mean that you have to rush out and read the Fair Tax book before you read this one. Still, we suspect that when you're finished here, you're probably going to want to go back and read the original just to expand your understanding of the history of our income tax, the concept of embedded taxes and tax compliance costs, and the way that our current system of raising federal revenues hamstrings American businesses, harasses our citizens, and assaults basic common sense. As an aside, let me tell you this. The chapter in the original Fair Tax book that details the history of the federal income tax, well, in all due modesty, I would like to say that some people have said that that is the absolute best history of the income tax they have ever read anywhere. Thank you very much. Now, we hope to accomplish several goals with this book. First, we wish to expand your understanding of just how the fair tax will work when it is implemented. Second, we want to arm you with the ammunition you need to respond to criticisms, both petty and substantive, of the fair tax plan. And trust us, there have been plenty of petty criticisms out there. And finally, we would like to share with you our vision for the future of our country under the fair tax. Having spent decades talking over the merits of consumption taxation with one another, it seems like just yesterday that the Americans for Fair Taxation made the fair tax an official bill in Congress, yet 1999 was almost a decade ago. Congressman Linder still remembers having to teach House staffers to describe the bill as the fair tax, not a fair tax, or much worse, the flat tax. We've both corrected literally thousands of callers and questioners by saying, we're not promoting a national retail sales tax, we're promoting the fair tax, a personal consumption tax carefully designed to capture the benefits of a national retail sales tax while minimizing the potential shortcomings of such a plan. Now, from those beginnings, the fair tax movement has spread across the nation. For a number of years now, for example, it has been nearly impossible to seek election to state or federal public office in the state of Georgia without taking a stand on the fair tax. The voters, well, they've simply demanded it. And now with the 2008 race for the White House already in progress, moderator George Stephanopoulos, former top advisor to President Bill Clinton, now chief Washington correspondent for ABC News, acting as the moderator of the first national Republican presidential debate, asked the candidates about the fair tax by name, trying to pin down each candidate on exactly where he stood on the issue. Now, why? Because the Iowa caucus is the first official vote in the presidential primary season, and the Iowa Republican Party had already endorsed the fair tax by name. So, from how do you spell it at the staff level to where do you stand on it at the presidential level in less than a decade? Why the success? Because both economists and the voters say that the fair tax is that important, and we agree, which is why we spend so much time on the issue ourselves. This book is another installment of our passion, which we believe reflects America's passion. Love the fair tax or hate it, we trust that this book is going to have an impact on your views. The fair tax book notwithstanding, we understand that the fair tax may be a new concept to you. You may have heard candidates and politicians talking about it. You may even have read a few columns or editorials on the subject and bought this book to find out more. Before asking you to absorb all kinds of detailed references to a prebate or to inclusive rather than exclusive taxes, first we should address a more fundamental question. Just what is this fair tax thing anyway? Instead of trying to explain the fair tax by running line by line through its legislative language, it'll probably be easier to review it principle by principle. After all, the fair tax was created as a matter of principle, as an attempt to pool the wisdom of a collection of economists, citizens, academics, and business leaders, and evolve a new set of ideas for fair taxation of the American people. The activist citizens who wrote the Fair Tax Act captured those principles and translated them faithfully into legislative language, which is found in bills introduced in both the House of Representatives, that's where the fair tax is known as H.R. 25, and in the U.S. Senate, where it's known as Senate 1025-1025. If you want to comb through the legislative language, the fair tax is only 133 double-spaced pages long. It's a quick read. It can be found at www.thomas.gov, which was, by the way, named for Thomas Jefferson. That's the Library of Congress website that offers citizens access to all congressional legislation. For a non-legislative perspective, you can go to fairtax.org, or you can go to johnlinder.com or Bortz, BOORTZ.com. A warning, if you go to Bortz.com, it may not be for the faint of heart or those who are easily offended. There's other stuff there, so log in with caution. All of these sources are based on the same core principles. The words of H.R. 25, found in those 133 pages on Capitol Hill? Well, they aren't the fair tax. That language can be changed with the stroke of a pen. And fair tax supporters are always open to new ways to perfect it. The fair tax is the collection of ideas that underlie H.R. 25. Those principles are immutable. And what are they? Well, maybe the best way to introduce the fair tax and the principles behind it is to share an open letter that was sent to the President and Congress by 76 economists from around the nation, economists who, like us, have put their names and reputations behind the fair tax. So now, I will read that letter to you. Dear Mr. President, members of Congress and fellow Americans, we, the undersigned business and university economists, welcome and applaud the ongoing initiative to reform the federal tax code. We urge the President and the Congress to work together in good faith to pass and sign into federal law H.R. 25 and S. 25, which together call for eliminating all federal income taxes for individuals and corporations, eliminating all federal payroll withholding taxes, abolishing estate and capital gains taxes, and repealing the 16th Amendment. We are not calling for elimination of federal taxation, which would be irresponsible and undesirable, nor does our endorsement call for reduced federal spending. The tax reform plan we endorse is revenue neutral, collecting as much federal tax revenue as the current income tax code, including payroll withholding taxes. We are calling for elimination of federal income taxes and federal payroll withholding taxes. We endorse replacing these costly, oppressively complex, and economically inefficient taxes with a progressive national retail sales tax, such as the plan offered by H.R. 25 and S. 25, which is also known as the Fair Tax Plan. The Fair Tax Plan has been introduced in the 109th Congress and had 54 co-sponsors in the 108th. If passed and signed into law, the Fair Tax would enable workers and retirees to receive 100% of their paychecks and pension benefits, replace all federal income and payroll taxes with a simple, progressive, visible, efficiently collected national retail sales tax, which would be levied on the final sale of newly produced goods and services. It would rebate to all households every month the federal sales tax they pay on basic necessities up to an independently determined level of spending, which removes the burden of federal taxation on the poor and makes the Fair Tax Plan as progressive as the current tax code. It would collect the national sales tax at the retail cash register, just as 45 states already do. It would set a federal sales tax rate that is revenue neutral, thereby raising the same amount of tax revenue as now raised by federal income taxes plus payroll withholding taxes. It would continue Social Security and Medicare benefits as provided by law. Only the means of tax collection changes. It would eliminate all filing of individual federal tax returns. It would eliminate the IRS and all audits of individual taxpayers. Only audits of retailers would be needed, greatly reducing the cost of enforcing the federal tax code. It would allow states the option of collecting the national retail sales tax in return for a fee, along with their state and local sales taxes. It would collect federal sales tax from every retail consumer in the country, whether citizen or undocumented alien, which will enlarge the federal tax base. It will collect federal sales taxes on all consumption spending on new final goods and services, whether the dollars used to finance the spending are generated legally, illegally, or in the huge underground economy. It would dramatically reduce federal tax compliance costs paid by businesses, which are now embedded and hidden in retail prices, placing U.S. businesses at a disadvantage in world markets. It would bring greater accountability and visibility to the federal tax collection system. It would attract foreign equity investment to the United States, as well as encourage U.S. firms to locate new capital projects in the United States that might otherwise go abroad. And it would not tax spending for education, since H.R. 25 and S. 25 define expenditure on education to be investment, not consumption, which will make education about half as expensive for American families as it is right now. The current U.S. income tax code is widely regarded by just about everybody as unfair, complex, wasteful, confusing, and costly. Businesses and other organizations spend more than 6 billion hours every year complying with the federal tax code. Estimated compliance costs conservatively top $225 billion annually, costs that are ultimately embedded in the retail price paid by the consumers. The Internal Revenue Code simply cannot be fixed, which is amply demonstrated by more than 35 years of attempted tax code reform, each round resulting in yet more complexity and unrelenting page after page, mind-numbing verbiage, now exceeding 54,000 pages containing more than 2.8 million words. Our nation's current income tax alters business decisions in ways that limit growth in productivity. The federal income tax also alters saving and investment decisions of households, which dramatically reduces the economy's potential for job and growth creation. Payroll withholding taxes are regressive, hitting hardest those least able to pay. Simply stated, the complexity and frequently changing rules of the federal income tax code make our country less competitive in the global economy and rob the nation of its full potential for growth and job creation. In summary, the economic benefits of the Fair Tax Plan are compelling. The Fair Tax Plan eliminates the tax bias against work, saving, and investment, which would lead to higher rates of economic growth, faster growth in productivity, more jobs, lower interest rates, and a higher standard of living for the American people. The America proposed by the Fair Tax would feature no federal income taxes, no payroll taxes, no self-employment taxes, no capital gains taxes, no gift or estate taxes, no alternative minimum taxes, no corporate taxes, no payroll withholding, no taxes on Social Security benefits or pension benefits, no personal tax forms, no personal or business income tax record keeping, and no personal income tax filing whatsoever. No Internal Revenue Service, no April 15th, all gone forever. We believe that many Americans will favor the fair tax proposed by H.R. 25 and S. 25, although some may say it simply can't be done. Many said the same thing to the grassroots progressives who won women the right to vote, to those who made collective bargaining a reality for union members, and to the freedom riders who made civil rights a reality in America. We urge Congress not to abandon the Fair Tax Plan simply because it will be difficult to face the objections of entrenched special interest groups, groups who now benefit from the complexity and tax preferences of the status quo. The comparative advantage and benefits offered by the Fair Tax to the vast majority of Americans is simply too high a cost to pay. Therefore, we, the undersigned professional and university economist, endorse a progressive national retail sales tax plan as provided by the Fair Tax Plan. We urge Congress to make H.R. 25 and S. 25 federal law and then work to swiftly repeal the 16th Amendment. Now, if you get out a pencil and a piece of paper, you can view this entire letter complete with the names of every one of these economists who signed it at fairtax.org/pdf/open_letter.pdf. And it is really, really worth reading. Now, before we get to the meat and potatoes of the Fair Tax Plan, let's expand on one point contained in that letter to correct any possible misconceptions. The letter says that the Fair Tax creates a national retail sales tax, which would be levied on the final sale of newly produced goods and services. However, this does not mean that the prices of those retail goods and services would necessarily go up. If the Fair Tax has one shortcoming, it's this. It is easy to demagogue. It is easy to attack. Perhaps the most oft-repeated demagogic attack on the Fair Tax is that it will add 23% to the cost of everything that we buy. This, as you will learn in this book, is false, because the Fair Tax is an embedded sales tax. That is, it will be included in the price that you pay, not added to the price that you pay. It will not increase the price of the goods and services you buy. As we'll see, the retail prices you pay today already contain these embedded taxes. They're merely there in a different form. The fair tax replaces one embedded tax with another. Now, here's what we've seen. As people begin absorbing these points, coming to understand the fair tax more fully, and as they become familiar with the complaints of the critics and where their logic falls apart, they tend to be won over, and more of them join the hundreds of thousands of fair tax volunteers and activists. The tide is running against the income tax. Change is inevitable. That change will come upon us either chaotically or through a well-thought-out plan that promotes freedom and economic liberty while propelling our economy and our country to new heights. So, let's begin. Chapter 1, the title here is The Ball is Rolling. Books on taxes usually sell by the dozens. So said a conservative columnist to Congressman John Linder on the occasion of the release of the Fair Tax Book. But he didn't mean it as a critique. Rather, he made the statement in utter amazement upon learning that the Fair Tax Book had debuted number one on the New York Times bestseller list. You think the media was surprised? Trust us, nobody was as surprised as we were when the news came. Well, except maybe our publishers, they might have been surprised. We can't think of a book on a subject so seemingly mundane that debuted at number one. So after a few weeks at the top of the list, copies of the Fair Tax Book became scarce, but the presses were put into overdrive, and before long, the book became a nationwide phenomenon. Our experience with the Fair Tax Book was a completely unexpected and thoroughly exhilarating roller coaster ride. We learned more than we could have ever imagined about the American public and its passion for change. We learned, for instance, that thousands of people would be willing to drive hundreds of miles just to show their support for an idea, not for a sports team, not for a political candidate, not for a day at Disney World or the beach, but for an idea. Okay, the date was May 24th, 2006. Man, I remember this. The place was Duluth, Georgia, just north of Atlanta. My flagship radio station, the mothership, News Talk 750 WSB, had rented a convention center with room for about 4,500 people for a fair tax rally. Sean Hannity agreed to be there, and we lined up other guests like John Stossel, Herman Cain, and Clark Howard, plus a little entertainment from Atlanta's own Banks and Shane. Then we sat back and fretted. Here we were, setting up a rally in the middle of the week for tax reform. Now, I'm the kind of guy that when I throw a party, which I don't do very often, I sit around thinking, okay, here's all the hors d'oeuvres, everything's all set, now nobody's going to show up, and I'm going to be dumping all of this stuff. Well, that's the way I felt about this rally. After a long day at work, wouldn't people want to be home with their families? And there were plenty of other events that were competing for attention, including a high school graduation taking place next door to the convention center. But it was too late to turn back now, so there we sat, hoping not to be embarrassed by a lot of empty seats. And trust me, we weren't. Hours before the start of the rally, the local police had their hands full with traffic. When the 4,500-seat venue sold out, WSB Radio announced that any fair tax supporters that were listening to their radio still en route to the event should just turn around and go home. There was simply no more room. Now, some did. Some turned their cars around and went home. A lot didn't. They kept coming, even though they knew they couldn't get inside the rally. While 4,500 people sat inside that convention center and celebrated and enjoyed the rally. Another 5,000 sat in their cars in the convention center parking lot, listening and cheering and beeping their horns as the rally unfolded on their car radios. Rob Woodall, who helped us with this book, John Linder's chief of staff and co-conspirator, was one of those who was turned away. He couldn't get in. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution had a headline: Rally for National Sales Tax Draws Overflow Crowd. Well, there's an understatement. 4,500 people inside, 5,000 people sitting out there in the parking lot, and who knows how many more stranded in traffic. After the Atlanta rally, we received literally hundreds of emails from people who hadn't made it inside the convention center, and others who had simply turned around and headed home when they heard on the radio that it was full. One lady came all the way from Louisiana. She was making her way through the Atlanta traffic with her husband and two neighbors when they heard on the radio they wouldn't be able to get into the building. They turned around in Atlanta and just drove back to Louisiana, but they promised to be at the next rally, and they promised to get there early. Now think about that for a moment. Four people in a car drive hundreds of miles for a tax reform rally? And then when they're turned away, they don't scream and shout and complain and spin around on their eyebrows and spit wooden nickels. Instead, they actually write us to apologize for not getting there earlier, and then they promise to make the next rally. Well, our Louisiana friends didn't have to wait long. The second fair tax rally was held 2 months later, July 29th, on the streets, on the asphalt in downtown Orlando. Are you listening here? Noon time, July 29th, Orlando, Florida. Hot? Let me tell you about hot. The temperature on those streets was almost 100 degrees when that rally began, and the crowd ran as high as 11,000 people. Despite the heat and the Florida humidity, they came, they stayed, and they rallied to show their support for the fair tax. We learned something else at the Orlando rally: that this new fair tax movement might be in for a bit of stonewalling from the media. Now, we had aerial photographs that clearly showed the size of the crowd. There was a seating area in front of the stage. We knew how many seats there were, and they were filled. And we could take the size of that seating area and then place it over the rest of the crowd to get a reasonable crowd estimate. We knew that we were in the neighborhood of between 10 and 11,000 people, but at least one local TV news station in Orlando persisted in broadcasting the news that only about 2,000 people showed up for the rally. It was a lie. It was a bald-faced lie. And of course, it was our first experience with the media seeming to actively work against the idea of the fair tax. Somehow, 10 or 11,000 really sweaty people became invisible to this TV reporter. Now, all of these people were there in Orlando trying to do something about taxes, mind you. They weren't there for a football game. They weren't there for a rock concert. They weren't there for an American Idol tryout. They were there for a tax rally. And then the momentum just kept on building. Tuesday, May 15th, 2007, the Republicans held one of their first presidential debates in Columbia, South Carolina. So off we went to Columbia. We rented an arena right next to the debate venue. Once again, Sean Hannity, Herman Cain, Banks and Shane, John Stossel, and the crew from Americans for Fair Taxation. And we had ourselves, oh, by the way, the swinging medallions were there too. We had ourselves another rally. About 8,000 people showed up this time. And just before the presidential debate was to start, all 8,000 people took to the streets to march around the building housing the presidential debate. They all carried these fair tax signs. Now, the media? I don't get it, folks. They completely ignored us. That night, they led the news with the exciting story of a small band of about 8 anti-war protesters had shown up. 8 anti-war protesters over there, 8,000 fair tax supporters marching with signs. The anti-war protesters, they get the press. Events like this have given us a kind of rolling education in how politics works in America. Here's a short list of what we've learned while America was learning about the fair tax. We've learned that the fair tax is an idea that people love and an idea the media mostly loves to ignore. We've learned that we still have a lot to learn about the forces that oppose change, but that there's still room in the vitriolic environment of American politics to discuss and debate big ideas. We've learned that political insiders and K Street lobbyists who make their livings and derive immense power from maintaining and manipulating the current tax system are thoroughly petrified by the fair tax and will do almost anything to derail it, include telling lies. Not ordinary, innocent, little lies, but the bold-faced, through-their-teeth kind of lies. We've learned that many congressional and campaign staffers who advise their principals on tax issues fear the fair tax because they fear allowing their bosses to lead. We've learned that opponents who want to criticize the fair tax often feel compelled to misrepresent its principles or to lie about it outright to give themselves something to shout about. We've learned that the more ordinary Americans familiarize themselves with the details of the fair tax, the more those attempts at demagoguery backfire. Some of the attacks on the fair tax have been rather personal. Naturally, partisan politics has also colored the debate. Trust us, the temptation is great to call out the critics by name, right here, right in this audiobook, in the pages of The Fair Tax, The Truth. That might be personally satisfying, but it would do little to advance the cause. We might let slip an occasional name where there's some personal animus behind that person's critiques of the fair tax, but for the most part, we feel confident that we can convert many of our critics with clear explanations of what the fair tax really is and what it is not. Sometimes all it takes is just a little gentle nudging. One reason we'll try not to attack people personally is that it's not always clear where the attacks are really coming from. Many of our fellow supporters have written their congressmen and senators asking whether they support the fair tax, and they forwarded us copies of the response letters they've received. Many of these letters were written by staff members who clearly have no clue what they're talking about or who have their own agendas they want to protect. Imagine, then, what kind of response we'd get if we let off a section of this book with something like this. Our next criticism comes from Congressman Sternfalter of East Dakotistan. Judging from the congressman's lack of understanding of the fair tax, we must assume that if you shoved his brains into a pistachio shell, they would rattle around like a BB in a boxcar. That sounds clever and fun, but you land a blow like that on a critic, and you have to write off any hope of converting that critic, Congressman Sternfalter, even if we proved that the fair tax could cure the common cold. But don't worry. If you know anything about the personality of, well, me, the talk show co-author, you know that I'm muttering under my breath about the ignorance, feigned or otherwise, of some of these critics. Some habits are just hard to break. Chapter 2, the title is Why Now and Why Us? Well, the first fair tax book came out about 3 years ago. So why a new book now? Well, two words. Election. Year. In the coming months, we're going to be electing the next president of the United States. Changing the leader of the free world is a big step all by itself, but in America, we like to do things really big. So on that same day, we're also going to choose 435 members of the House of Representatives, the entire House, that is, for those of you who haven't yet taken American Government 101 in school. We're going to elect 33 new members to the U.S. Senate, that's roughly a third of that body, 11 new state governors, and literally thousands of other state and local political leaders. That one day, November 4th, 2008, will change the entire face of American political leadership, and the entire thing will happen without one gun, one tank, or one drop of blood. Unless, of course, somebody cuts themselves on a hanging chad or something. Representative government is truly an amazing thing. Rather than fighting it out in the streets, when it comes time to change leaders, we Americans wage a battle of ideas with one another. We battle over competing visions of how we should be governed, how we should live our lives, how our children should be educated. We fight over which ideas will save more American jobs and which ideals will preserve more American freedom. These are daily battles, but they culminate every 4 years in November. We're writing this book now because we feel that this year the fair tax needs to be a part of the battle of ideas. Sadly, truth is often a casualty of the political and ideological contests that are waged in November, just as it probably will be on the evening news tonight, on the floor of the House tomorrow, and certainly on the pages of many of America's newspapers later in the week. Whenever passion prevails over reason, truth becomes a casualty. To prevent the fair tax from becoming such a casualty, we want to put the truth about the fair tax out there in black and white for everybody to see, providing a ready reference for both politicians and voters who are seeking answers. As we look back on our last 5 years, we're almost embarrassed to tell you how much time we've spent working on the fair tax. Now, our wives could tell you, but we're not sure that they would be smiling when they did. As we've said, the fair tax idea, as captured in the legislative speak of H.R. 25, is only 133 pages long. So all these years later, why is it that we're still working to explain such a short bill? Well, for starters, we're a very large nation, 300 million different interests and goals. This may be a short book, but make no mistake, this is a very large topic, one that can and will impact the lives of every single person living within our borders, and perhaps an equal number who do not. That's a challenging idea for 300 million people to absorb. Of course, there are hundreds of thousands of volunteers across the country out there every day helping to explain it. We're constantly amazed at how often we hear an attack on the fair tax in the press and then see it rebutted by a supporter who is unknown to us, yet is clearly informed and knowledgeable about the bill. Between the volunteers and ourselves, literally thousands of years' worth of man-hours have been spent in support of the fair tax, but the battle continues. The good news is that the fair tax has gained so much traction on the national stage that some very serious people have begun exploring it. Some are praising it. Others are criticizing it. The uninformed attacks don't merit too much attention. If you've purchased this book, you're certainly bright enough to know when a fair tax opponent is showing signs of desperation. The simple answer for most of these critics is just to suggest that they take the time to read the fair tax bill and then reconsider their attack. It could save them from embarrassment. But the serious critics and criticisms do deserve attention, and that's what makes this book necessary. For many of you, we hope it will serve as a how-to guide for answering the tough questions you might hear from a neighbor or coworker. Our responses might seem a bit more aggressive than they need to be, but we'll leave it to you to judge when to use honey and when to bring out the vinegar. Now, you may be asking yourself, are the 133 pages of the fair tax bill really important enough to cause all of that fuss? And the answer, are you waiting for this? The answer is no. Why? Because those 133 pages are simply the best effort of legislative lawyers to capture the fair tax vision in legislative language. Changing the bill is literally as easy as Congressman Linder scratching something on the back of a napkin and giving it to the House clerk. It's a fungible document, always subject to improvement. Do you know what definitely is worth the fuss? That would be the fair tax vision. The fair tax is a collection of fundamental economic principles and American societal goals that are fixed and unchanging. It's the principle and goals that we're working toward, whatever the language we use to express it. If at the end of the day those economic principles and societal goals are passed in the law, the American people can declare victory. And what are those principles? In short words, here is what we think the American tax system should be. It should be simple. Any true tax reform must result in a tax code that is easy for every American to understand, regardless of education, occupation, or station in life. And the Fair Tax Plan is simple. It eliminates more than 67,000 pages of complexities in the current income tax code once and for all, replacing them with a simple, uniform tax on personal consumption. Now, tax reform should be fair. Fundamental tax reform must protect the poor and treat everybody else equally. No exemptions, no exclusions, no advantages. The Fair Tax Plan is fair. It contains a rebate, or prebate, if you will, of the sales tax for every household, designed to cover fully the tax consequences of spending right up to the poverty line. This prebate protects low-income Americans, ensuring that every household can buy necessities tax-free. Under the fair tax, all American citizens receive equal treatment. A tax system should, if you can make it so, be voluntary. Americans deserve a tax system that is not coercive or intrusive.